You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Josh Larson.
How come you ain't never liked me?
Like you? Who the hell said I got to like you? What law is there say I got to like you? Want to stand up in front of my face and ask a damn fool-ass question like that? Talking about liking somebody. Come here, boy, when I talk to you.
Yes, sir.
Denzel talks, we listen. A clip there from Fences, which opened wide over Christmas. Denzel Washington stars and directs the adaptation of August Wilson's play, which won the Pulitzer and Tony in 1987.
This week, some thoughts on Fences and Patterson, the latest from Jim Jarmusch. Plus, we revisit our September conversation with comedian, activist, and Denzelit W. Kamau Bell.
That's all ahead on Film Spotting.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
Apes hunt humans.
That is wrong. Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
We are recovering, I think that's the right word to use here, Josh, from our four-hour pairing of Best of 2016 shows, part one and two, with Scott Tobias and Genevieve Kosky, who did a great job coming to us from the Next Picture Show.
4 hours only?
Yeah, 4 hours only. Actually, maybe a little bit over four by the time it was all said
and done.
I would
have guessed a little bit over. I think one of these years we're going to produce one of these Best of two-parters that just extends all the way into the following year. People can listen to it for a whole year before they get done.
Let's go for it.
Okay.
We are thinking about making some tweaks to the format of those top 10 shows, though we'll keep them two parts. And yes, we probably will keep them two very long parts, but we'll see how that goes as we're actually approaching those end of year shows next December. For now, we're prepping for our live show. We're going to put a bow on 2016 officially, our end of year wrap party. It's coming up on Friday, January 13th at the Logan Center for the Arts. It's at the University of Chicago campus. There are tickets available, and all the information you need, including how to buy tickets, is at filmspotting.net.
Things are coming together for this. I'm starting to compile my picks for my scenes. Mm-hmm. And from what I understand, we're lining up a ton of guests. I can't keep up with them. Who have we got so far?
Well, I can definitely mention Tasha Robinson, also from The Next Picture Show and The Verge, is going to join us on stage as she did last year. The great Michael Phillips is going
to
join us.
I know he was
on stage.
Iffy, so that's good to hear.
No, he is officially in. And Stephen Cohn, a great Chicago filmmaker who had a very movie come out in 2016, Henry Gamble's Birthday Party. He's going to join us for a category. So it's going to be a good time, and it's going to be, and I think this is a good thing that we can really plug here, Josh, it's going to be more video heavy than any of these shows have been. We're making sure that when we get to those scenes that we are awarding our funniest moment, our most moving moment, our scene of the year, we're ensuring that we can actually play those on the screen. It's so much better to show them and then talk about them and have that kind of exchange and that dialogue with the crowd who is watching them along with us. So maybe going to feel a little bit more like film school than our traditional live shows, but I'm excited about that.
Well, and from what I understand, this venue, this screen is fantastic. That's what Tyler Green, who is our live event producer, has said. He got a chance to check it out. And so the scene should play really well. I'm looking forward to giving this a whirl.
Yeah. And I should mention that those names that I threw out there, those aren't the only guests we have planned. We do have a few other people who are going to chime in via video, as we did with last year's wrap party. So it should be a fun film spotting evening, and we promise that it won't be 4 hours. It won't even be 2 hours.
That's the goal. 90 minutes.
90 minutes. 90 minutes is what Tyler is going to enforce. I think he'll actually just start playing the music and it'll be like the Oscars. We have to get off the stage.
I like it. I don't blame him if he does that.
Well, as we said, we're obviously working on that show, getting everything ready. And this is the time of year where we usually do some kind of film spotting fix. And this one has blossomed into mostly a full-blown show. But we've always had, or at least recently, we've had some pairs of films to get into a fight about. 2014, we had The Wolf of Wall Street versus American Hustle. Mm-hmm. 2015, we had The Hateful Eight versus The Revenant. The end of 2016, it really hasn't offered anything so divisive, unless you count the fact, and I do, of course, that you only seem to kind of passive-aggressively enjoy Sing Street, and that doesn't work for me. I need aggressive.
You're mischaracterizing that quite a bit. And what makes you think we're not going to get into a Patterson v. Fences showdown? Well, you don't see that coming?
I don't, actually.
I don't either.
But you never know. So we're going to dig into a couple of those year-end releases. Patterson, a limited release that is going to expand to a few more theaters, including here in Chicago, later in January, and Fences, which did open over Christmas. These two films, Fences and Patterson, Josh, both came up in our second part of the top 10 films of 2016 show. Scott Tobias had Patterson as his number 5 film of the year, and Odie Henderson from RogerEbert.com called in. He had Fences as his number 1 movie of the year. And looking at them on the surface, a Jim Jarmusch film and an adaptation of an August Wilson play, they seemingly couldn't be more different. And yet, as I thought about them, because we sort of arbitrarily grouped them together for this episode, it occurred to me that they have some similarities. They're both fairly confined movies in that they don't stray too far outside the characters' homes and then a few other regular spots. They're primarily about working class men. Adam Driver's Patterson gets up every day to drive a bus, and Denzel Washington's Troy drives a garbage truck. This one may be a little bit of a stretch, but I couldn't help but notice Patterson's structure taking us through a week in the life of Patterson and his wife, Laura. Fences covers a much greater expanse of time, but that daily grind is reflected in the way Fridays are pivotal days in this movie because it's payday. They're also both very much movies about marriages and the daily negotiations that define those occasionally difficult relationships. Viola Davis plays Troy's wife, Rose, in Fences. Gulshifteh Farahani is Patterson's wife. Josh, maybe I'm still stuck in battle mode from these past few years. We don't need to pit these two movies against each other, but I'm curious, do you have a clear favorite among these two, Fences and Patterson?
Yeah, I do. It's Patterson. I mean, I like them both, so I can't really pit them against each other. Patterson, though, is the one I would say I wasn't quite sure what to do with upon first viewing, even though I knew I really liked it. I couldn't figure out why I really liked it. It was an instinctual response. But once I tried to articulate that, and I saw it in the rush of year-end screening, so it was a jumble. Didn't really sit down and write about it at all. We didn't get a chance to talk about it. It was just that instinctual love for this movie. And revisiting it again, I think I came to a little bit more of an idea of why not just I'm appreciating it, but people like Scott, as you said, I've seen it on a few other top 10 lists. And there seems to be a recurring phrase that comes up, or a description of people's experience with this movie. I think Scott might have said something like this. They want to just stay in this world and experience more time with this couple and these people. What's interesting to me about that is there's nothing particularly remarkable on the surface of this world. It's not like a fantasy world that someone might want to explore or anything like that. This is a couple living in a modest home, in a modest town, having a modest life. But
there are a few things that I think do distinguish it. And one is the Jarmusch level of quirkiness that we always expect. And I'm using that quirkiness as a positive term. Mm-hmm. Jarmusch was around back when quirkiness was still okay.
Of course
he invented
it. Of course you are president of the Wes Anderson fan.
Exactly. Jarmusch invented quirkiness, the good sort of quirkiness, in a lot of ways. Here, though, it's so relaxed. It almost verges on naturalism. So that the fact that Laura has these creative art projects she does every day, they're not just character traits. They're decisions born out of her as a person, mm-hmm. that we feel. And you could say the same with Patterson.
Yeah.
The fact that he doesn't have a mobile phone isn't a joke, you know, isn't supposed to be a signifier. It's really something he's chosen for specific mm-hmm. reasons we come to understand. So they're quirky in a way that's naturalistic and appealing. But here's what I finally came upon. Why Patterson is such an enjoyable movie to sit within. These two are so content.
Yeah.
And that is something that most of us can't quite achieve on a daily basis. They have their routine. They have their enjoyment of each other. Not to say that there aren't things they're not on the same page about. We'll get to Marvin, her dog, I'm sure, in the course of this review. But generally, they're content with their lives. They're content with their station. They're content with the level of artistic endeavors that they're involved in. Even though Laura, who says she wants to be a country singer and a star, for her, fame really means that her cupcakes are a hit at the local farmer's market.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's really what she means. Patterson doesn't want the poetry that he's written to even get Xeroxed for safekeeping, let alone published. They're happy to be participating in these endeavors. It adds to their lives, and it's just a beguiling experience to watch them do that.
Hello, darling.
Oh, honey.
I'm painting.
Hello, Marvin. I see that.
What do you think? Does it make everything more interesting?
Yeah, it's very interesting.
How was your day?
Well, the usual.
Getting your writing done?
I did a little, yeah.
We will talk about Fences more here in a little bit. I'm probably more of a Fences guy, and I don't necessarily mean that in terms of the quality of the two films, that I prefer Fences. They're very close for me. I like both films quite a bit. I mean it more in terms of how I'm wired. A little bit to my chagrin, I'm probably generally more of a glass half empty, life is a struggle, and I really enjoy the drama of those confrontations more than I enjoy, and I had the exact same word written in my notes, the contentment.
Mm-hmm.
I like the crescendos and the decrescendos and those volatile ebbs and flows that we get in a movie like Fences versus being on that just steady, mellow kind of rhythm that you get with a Jarmusch film that you certainly get with this film, Patterson. But my inability maybe to relate to it is also what makes me really appreciate this movie. And when I was formulating some thoughts about this movie earlier today, I wasn't thinking about trying to answer the question that you just posed about why a lot of critics, a lot of viewers, why you enjoy just being in this world. But I think I have an answer as well. And it all comes back to Adam Driver, his character, and what defines his character. He is a bus driver, but he is also a poet. He's truly an artist. He isn't necessarily looking to be rich and famous or even to be read, but it just is what defines his daily routine. He can't live, it seems, without collecting his thoughts and without exploring those thoughts on paper. And so what becomes fascinating for me, what's so refreshing for me, is watching him watch the world.
Yeah.
He's always observing. And that is partly because he doesn't have a cell phone. So he's not stuck on that iPhone or Android device like so many of us are every minute of every day. He's always observing, whether consciously or not, he is seeking inspiration. And when he has to keep his eyes on the road and he can only look in the mirror at the passengers, he's listening to what's being said. And what's being said is inspiring what he writes and inspiring sometimes revisions to what he writes. So that openness to the world and how he genuinely seems to love the world around him, that's contagious. And it did occur to me, I wonder if that's a little bit because through his eyes, the world's already pre-romanticized, meaning he lives in this town that he is named after, which the movie doesn't explain at all. It kind of has the one throwaway line. Yep, I'm named Patterson too. But he comes from this place that is the home or close to the home of the great poet William Carlos Williams and other artists as well. And like Jarmusch likes to do from time to time, we certainly saw it in Only Lovers Left Alive, he likes to showcase some of those faces that we see behind the bar in this film that Patterson frequents. But because so many notable figures are from this area and they've already romanticized this environment, that somehow opens the door for him to do it as well. And then that passes on to the viewer.
Except I think he's a genuine observer. I don't think he's setting out to necessarily copy any sort of poetry that came before, though the poems that we do see, and I love how we hear them in voiceover from Driver, and then they're scribbled onto the screen and we can actually see the text. I will say they're similar from the little I know of William Carlos Williams in style, and the fact that they concentrate on everyday detail and then blossom out from that into something more moving or even profound in some cases. So he is working in that tradition. And we should probably note those poems come from a contemporary poet named Ron Padgett, who wrote the three or four we maybe get in the film. And, you know, I'm no poetry expert. I'd like to have other people explain to me how a poem is working. So I can't say how great they are, but I definitely appreciated them in my first impression and really appreciated Driver's reading of them, I think is key.
Another one. When you're a child, you learn there are three dimensions, height, width, and depth, like a shoebox. Then later you hear there's a fourth dimension, time. Then some say there can be five, six, seven. I knock off work, have a beer at the bar. I look down at the glass and feel glad.
Going back to, you know, Patterson being a observant man, and I think it's interesting how Jarmusch's camera here, it's a little different than a main character's POV. We really get his artistic eye, in a sense.
Yes.
That's when we get these shots.
We see him looking.
Only when he's observing something that's going to work its way into his poetry, or even something just that just gives him pause. And you can see that this is how his mind is working. When he wakes up one morning in bed, as we see every morning, suddenly we get that perspective of him looking up at the ceiling. Or when he goes for his nightly stop at the bar while he's walking Marvin, and we see him looking down into his glass of beer. And I believe that does surface in a poem later. So I do like how the camera works in that way. And going back to Driver, as far as reading these poems, it's partly that he reads them as if he's writing them. So they're not recitations of complete poems, right? He gives pauses, and then he gives a rush of words, which is exactly how the pacing of writing
works. That's a good point.
It's such a nice touch that he gives in the performance. This was one of my favorite performances of the year because it had things like that while also being so funny in a quiet way, in an understated way, and all the things that Driver has to do, because Patterson is such a soft-spoken guy. Everything we know about how he's feeling is conveyed in little things like how big he smiles, when he looks at Laura or when he says something while looking away, how loudly he laughs. And every one of those touches is so quiet yet so meaningful. And I also think you got to give him credit for having such great chemistry with Marvin the dog. He has probably better chemistry with Marvin than he does with Laura.
Their whole relationship is predicated on an open
antagonism,
dislike.
Yes, that only the two of them are really aware of.
That's true.
And it may sound like it's easy to get dog jokes, right? Animal jokes in a movie. But until you see this compared with something like, I don't know, what are the Marley films or, you know, a kitty animal film? There is some great timing going on here in the interaction between them. A sight gag we will not give away, but is among the funniest things I saw this year. Debbie, you should have heard Debbie's exclamation when that was revealed.
Outside the house. I know what you're talking about.
She says, that little, and I can't say the rest of it because it was quite vulgar, but that is a great moment in this movie.
When I think of Debbie, I think quite vulgar.
Oh, yes.
Always. Yeah, not to try to compare the performances at all because they couldn't be more different by design, but in Fences, Denzel Washington, all the characters there, but especially Troy is always telling you exactly what's on his mind, whether you want to hear it or
not.
And loudly. And Adam Driver here as Patterson, he more betrays his feelings to you. He's not open about it, but through those gestures.
Yeah,
and
you're right. That's
just
good.
The size of his smile or the lack of a smile. Sometimes you are actually able to read what he might truly be feeling.
And then he'll quickly retract it sometimes too, which speaks to your point about betraying.
Yeah. Now maybe it's the English major in me. It's going to force me, Josh, to actually recite some poetry here. And I am going to do it because I think the magic of
this film. You better be up to it because they do it pretty good in this film.
I doubt that.
I don't want you to spoil my experience.
You've heard me act. You know this is going to be bad. But I think the magic of this film relates to the magic of the poet at the center of this film, William Carlos Williams. Jarmusch, with the material, he couldn't be more literal. And you touched on this in terms of what we're seeing unfold on the screen is quotidian stuff. And yet it all becomes poetic because of how it's framed. So despite its literalness at times, its semi-naturalism, if you will, it somehow becomes really figurative and evocative. And you know who was the master of that? It was William Carlos Williams. These two poems are both read at points in the movie. And I remember discovering this poem as a junior or senior in high school, taking a lit class and having my world opened up to poetry like this, despite the simplicity, the utter simplicity of it. So much depends upon a red wheelbarrow glazed with rainwater beside the white chickens. I don't have to explain to you the poignancy of that. I think it's there in the words, and yet it's just a few lines, four very short stanzas. And then this is just to say, I have eaten the plums that were in the icebox and which you were probably saving for breakfast. Forgive me, they were delicious, so sweet and so cold. That's great stuff.
Yeah.
It just is. And again, it is because it's there on the page. It's evocative in being so direct and so straightforward and so literal, and yet the power of it is undeniable. And whether he was openly trying to mimic William Carlos Williams or not, I think we see this in a lot of Jarmusch films, he has nevertheless accomplished the same feat in showing us just the everyday concerns and the daily grind of this man and his wife, and yet striving for something more, the way we can get a bit of transcendence beyond just the everyday simply by observing the everyday.
Yeah, the opening poem in the film, I think it's called Love Poem. So it's Patterson's, but actually it's Ron Padgett's. It works very much in the same way as this is just to say, starting with something everyday and mundane, Ohio blue tip matches, right?
Right.
But it does something a little different than at the end where it becomes this, it ignites, to use the imagery that the poem does, it suddenly ignites into something more where we're leapt into what it says it is, a love poem. So it starts as something observing what these matches look like, the color of the head tips, and then becomes something much more. And that's really a stand-in also for, which goes to what you were just saying, how Patterson, the film, works overall. I mean, this is the people in this movie, they have a small life, but it's abundantly full, right? And this is a modest movie that is somehow hugely full. It feels like it's going to burst. Like there's so much in it that it's going to burst. But that's why my first reaction was so confused. You look back and say, well, why did I respond that way? Because nothing really happened. But it is pulling out this full meaning within the everyday that is something of a minor miracle the film manages.
Yeah. And being someone who is fascinated by the artistic process, any creative process, and watching it unfold on film. I mentioned this on the Top 10 show when Scott brought it up, but I love that we do see that revision process, that it's not a matter of that Ohio blue tip match poem coming into the world fully formed.
Yeah, he just spits
so
it out.
It's there in Driver's reading of it, but also in the fact that Jarmusch comes back to it a couple more times. So whether or not he's an amazing poet, we can debate that. He's certainly not a bad poet, and we come to realize that because we watch how he revises, how he alters and adds and expands on that initial spark, to go back to the imagery there of the match. But he just uses that to then go in different directions. And by that third revision, it is a better poem, I think, by almost any objective standard, because somehow the voice and the vision that he has been seeking, it does come through in that process. So I love watching the process. The other thing about this movie I think is really interesting that we should probably touch on is that marriage dynamic a little bit, because Laura is a character who in some ways couldn't be more different than Patterson. She's impulsive. She's definitely quirky. She's untethered a bit from reality, I'd say. And there are times where she's pretty annoying. And that comes through even with Patterson. You can read that on his face, I think, as well. And I really appreciate the fact, actually, that Jarmusch doesn't try to reconcile that. I think he wants to challenge us a little bit to think what a marriage can be. And it doesn't always have to be a case where everything the other person says is something that you delight in. And at the same time, it doesn't have to be this hugely volatile thing either. It can be something that you just do figure out moment to moment, day by day. And we see it in comparison to something like the relationship at the bar, which is its own little drama between two side characters in this film. Every time he goes to the bar, it seems they're engaged in some kind of histrionics that almost seem like they're part of their own play. And whatever that dynamic is, well, that could be love, or we could see love as it plays out between Patterson and Laura, and I think I would choose that one.
Yeah, I think that's part of the intricacy of Driver's performance, is you can sense when his delight over Laura's latest creative flourish is genuine, and when it's confused, yeah. And when it's a little impatient.
Right.
And I like that, too. I mean, that it isn't this picturesque relationship, necessarily. Mm-hmm. Now, maybe the argument could be made that Farahani, who's pretty wonderful in mm-hmm. the supporting part, doesn't get as much to work with. I mean, obviously, she doesn't have as much screen time. She's not the title character.
No.
Though I do like when they break up their routine and go out on a date to see a movie. And she gets to share some of her observances about this old black and white horror film that they see. And we sense some of the artistic appreciation that is at the bedrock of their relationship.
Right.
I mean, she respects the work he does as a bus driver,
yeah.
but she loves him as a poet.
Mm-hmm.
And he as well, maybe he's not as wild about her designs on the shower curtain she's painted that day, but he does love that she has this desire to mm-hmm. learn how to play country
music. Yeah, he's never going to discourage that.
And exactly. And so that, again, is where the foundation of their relationship probably mm-hmm. is.
Well, Patterson is a pretty delightful film, and it's currently out in limited release, so not many opportunities for those of you listening, wherever you may be, to see it, but it does open here in Chicago on January 20th. We're going to talk about Fences here in a moment, but we thought it would be a good opportunity to share a little bit of feedback as we are gearing up for the live show on January 13th, where we will announce the winner of this year's Film Spotting Golden Brick Award. This is our award that goes to our favorite underseen / overlooked movie of the year. And more than that, they come from new or emerging filmmakers and also show a very clear, strong directorial vision. We settled on 5 finalists, and those finalists are Camera Person, The Fitz, Kreisha, Tower, and The Witness. We allow the listeners to be part of the voting along with a few other special panelists and myself, you, Josh, Michael Phillips is one of them, our producer Sam Van Halgren, among those who weigh in as well. But we take the voting over at filmspotting.net very seriously. That counts just as much as my vote or your vote. And we're not going to share the results of the listener's choice vote at this point either, but we thought we would share a little bit of feedback as we gear up for the Golden Brick announcement.
Let's start with Josh Oakley from cutprintfilm.com. This was an easy pick for me, he says. I adore The Fitz, quite liked Kreisha, and still need to catch Tower and The Witness. But Camera Person is not just my favorite of the Golden Brick nominees, it's my favorite film of 2016. This is such a human and heart-wrenching film, both a moving portrait of director Kirsten Johnson and a wider view on how connected this diverse and troubling world truly is. That's a lesson we all need to hear at any time, but it's become vital at this point in our history. Camera Person isn't sentimental in this respect. In fact, the most stirring images are from areas of the world suffering from desolation and genocide. But there are such tender moments too, the entire spectrum of life captured in a beguiling experiment that pays endless dividends.
Well said, Josh. Danielle Duzeman goes with The Fitz. She says it was entrancing from start to finish and had such a subtle, quiet strength to it. The ending was absolutely breathtaking. Andrew Cochran goes a different direction. I think this is going to be a power struggle between Kreisha and The Fitz, and rightly so. Both movies use compelling imagery, defamiliarize familiar stories, and use the medium to interesting ends. At the end of the day, though, I have to go with Kreisha. Trey Edward Schultz's vision is so well actualized, his themes and emotions so wonderfully articulated. Also, perhaps most importantly, he used Nina Simone's Just in Time and didn't make me think instantly of Before Sunset. And let's be honest, guys, that's the criteria by which we should judge Golden Brick Awards.
We also heard from Brian Finch in Tampa, Florida. If the point of the Golden Brick is to shine a light on films that need to find a larger audience, then The Witness should win. This is a movie that is too good and tells such a compelling story about a fascinating individual to go unnoticed. And Adam has a kick-ass interview with the director, which I highly recommend to listen to after viewing this film. I would have never watched this movie if Adam and Josh didn't champion it. Thank you.
Thank you, Brian, for the kind words. That was definitely one of my favorite interviews of the year with the director of The Witness, James Solomon. Kevin writes in, thank you for including Tower on this list. It's a near-perfect Brick nominee, a bold and distinct vision that breathes fresh air into a genre that is underseen and uniquely championed by film spotting. The other films all deserve wider audiences and accolades, but I haven't seen Tower get the praise it deserves from just about any other outlet. I hope that Adam's number one placement will help listeners seek it out and recognize it as the exciting, moving document that it is. It was, in fact, my number one movie of the year.
And Seth sent us this note. I would love to be able to vote objectively on the Golden Brick this year, but I haven't had an opportunity to see Tower yet. I live in British Columbia, Canada, and it came nowhere near me and doesn't appear to be having any screenings near here in the future. Are there any paid online streaming services hosting it? I'm more than happy to pay to support the filmmakers. I just want a chance to see it.
So Seth wasn't alone in emailing or tweeting at us a comment along those lines. It seems I have intrigued people a little bit about the movie Tower, which is great to hear. And shortly after we taped the episode, so we couldn't get it in the episode, we got an email from Molly in Gaithersburg, Maryland, and she's got the answer to Seth's query. In one of your recent episodes, you mentioned that two Golden Brick contenders, Tower and The Witness, would be difficult to see anytime soon. Independent Lens, the PBS series highlighting the latest in independent cinema, starts a new season this month, and both these films will be part of it. The Witness will premiere on January 23rd, and Tower will premiere on February 14th. Of course, local stations may move their exact air dates, but the films will hopefully stream on the PBS website and apps after they broadcast too. So we all should be able to catch up with both these contenders if we've missed them in theaters. We should add that The Witness is currently streaming on Netflix, so you can access that film, but we will link to Independent Lens and more information on how and where to watch all of the 2016 Golden Brick finalists at filmspotting.net. Just click on top fives and you'll find that Golden Brick link. The poll is closed because the voting is in. We do know, Josh, we know who the winner is, but we're not going to spoil it. We're going to announce it on January 13th at that live show. And a little bit of a spoiler, not who's going to win, but in terms of those categories and some of our picks, as we have been assembling our various scenes, and we've been talking with some of our special guests about their scenes, these Golden Brick nominees, they're going to come up a couple times, not just in the Golden Brick category. They're going to get some love in other categories as
well. Yeah. Now that you mention it, I think I have two from Golden Brick.
I think I
nominees,
have at least two.
Okay.
And I know at least one guest has a pick as well. So if you haven't seen these movies, we hope you do seek them out. Most of them are available currently on some platform, Tower and The Witness being the two that are maybe a little bit more difficult, but hopefully we have remedied that a little bit.
If you want a chance to see some movies that are yet to be released, we've got that for you among the screening passes. We always love it when we're able to give these out. The first batch is for The Founder. This is with Michael Keaton playing McDonald's founder Ray Kroc. It opens here in Chicago on the 20th, and the screening we have passes for is on Tuesday the 17th. That's going to take place at the AMC River East. We also have Run of Engagement passes to 20th Century Women. This is with Annette Bening, directed by Mike Mills of Beginners. Women opens this weekend here in Chicago. So again, these are Run of Engagement passes. More information for how to enter to receive those is at filmspotting.net. Adam, you've seen 20th Century Women, right?
I have.
You were able to fit that in?
And I'll say I recommend it, but it's a movie that I want to give another viewing, and I would certainly love to discuss. I don't know if we're going to get an opportunity on the show. Mike Mills, for lack of a better word, is very busy during this film, much more so, I would say, than Beginners, but that's not necessarily a bad thing. And I really do love not only Annette Bening's performance, but Elle Fanning gives another great performance of the year. She was already so good in The Neon Demon. She is really wonderful here as a supporting character, but the whole ensemble really is pretty fantastic here. And there's a lot more to say about this movie. For now, I'm just going to say I do recommend it. I'm still struggling a little bit with just how strongly I recommend it. One more quick note. I mentioned this a few weeks back, but at the end of this month, I'm going to be out in Los Angeles the weekend of the 27th, that Friday, or possibly the Sunday night, the 29th. I'm going to be available and looking to get together. I've already talked with our good friends Brett Merriman out there and Jason Eakin, longtime listeners, and Peter Labuza, who's out there now as well at USC. And we're going to get together. We're going to do some kind of meetup one of those two nights. And because it may not come up again on any episodes before this happens on the 27th, here's what I can tell you. In the show notes at filmspotting.net for this episode, so 618, you will find a link to the thread in our Film Spotting forum where I will post details about the meetup as they are finalized. You don't have to be a member of the forum to read the thread. You do if you want to comment, but otherwise you can access the information just by clicking on that link. And I think that's probably the best way to do it. So once we finalize a time and location and a day, I will post all of it there and the link will be in our show notes.
Tell you what, how about I do the same for my days at Sundance, which is going to be at the end of the month, and I'll try to do something similar there. I've already heard from listener Tim Cosey, I think is how you pronounce it. He's going to be there. He's really excited, struggling to put together his list of movies that he wants to see. It's such a great lineup that they have this year. So he and I were going to try to get together. If there are other listeners, maybe we'll put those details as well at the same place.
Yeah.
It might be a little closer to the actual dates I'm there once, you know, my screening schedule is finalized and that sort of thing too. So, but that'd be great.
Yeah, it would. And I've talked to Michael Phillips and I know he is going to be out at Sundance.
Oh,
not
good.
The exact same dates as you, but I think you do have some overlap. So maybe we can even convince him to make an appearance.
That would be nice.
Kind of gathering.
I'll get in touch with him.
Oh, woman, come here. Oh, look here, Bruno. When I first met this woman, I got out that place there. Hitch up my pony, saddle up my mare. There's a woman out there for me somewhere. I looked at here, looked at there, saw Rose, and I latched on to her. I latched on to her, and I told her. No, I'm going to tell you the truth. I latched on to her and told her, baby, I don't want to marry. I just want to be your man. Rose told me. Tell him what you told me, Rose.
I told him if he wasn't a mankind, then move out the way so the mankind could find me.
That's what she told me. You're in my way. You're blocking the view. Move out the way so I can find me a husband. I thought it over 2-3 days.
Well, no, 2-3 days, nothing. You was back the same night.
Come back. Told her, okay, baby, but I'm going to buy me a banty rooster and put him out there in the backyard. And when he see a stranger come, he going to flap his wings and crow. Look here, Bono. I can watch that front door by myself. It was that back door I was worried about.
Let's move on to a little bit of Fences talk here. Josh, my sense is that this film has gotten mostly positive reviews, though even the positive ones, at least from what I've seen on sites like Twitter and Letterboxd, like to note how much of a play it very clearly is and what it owes to the August Wilson drama. I get it. I guess most of the action takes place in the Maxson backyard or inside the Maxson house, and it is a ton of dialogue with a lot of characters entering and exiting scenes. Otherwise, I have to be honest, I'm a little bit baffled by that criticism. Are you one of those people who feels that way?
Well, it's obvious that it's stage-bound material. I don't think, for me, the problem was less that it was stage-bound material. I mean, so is something like Glengarry Glen Ross, which works brilliantly, right? Then the choices Washington made as director to, quote unquote, open it up weren't always that helpful. There's some odd camera placement here where we're behind a shoulder, but in a way that almost obscures things. And maybe it would have been an even better film if it had just gone flat out stagey and not even made those attempts. But you know, those are minor quibbles. This is a movie I largely enjoyed, it, even though it does feel more like a play than a piece of cinema. The acting is at the forefront, as it should be. And this does star Washington, as we mentioned at the top, as Troy Maxson. He's in 1950s Pittsburgh. When we first meet him, he's on the back of a garbage truck, works his way up to become one of the first, if not the first, I think, African-American drivers in Pittsburgh. And this is the dynamic we see, is this guy who's in his 50s, I would say, do they name it? Seems about right. Who's chafing against the restrictions that a black man has in mid-century America. And it came up in comparison to Adam Driver's performance in Patterson, the different styles at work here. And I hope people didn't think that by contrasting them, I necessarily meant that Driver's quiet performance was better than Washington's loud performance here, because he's intended to be loud. Troy Maxson is always the biggest figure in the room, and he comes charging into this movie talking, yammering to his best friend on Friday, payday, hardly stops for the rest of the film. And that is a plus, because this is the sort of character Washington does best. He's a movie star actor. He has that charisma. This gives him a chance to put that at the forefront. This is a man he's playing who's the movie star of his own life, right? So I think that all works. And what's interesting also is how once we get under the surface and see some of Troy's darker qualities, then suddenly it's not so much an entertaining performance as a troubling one. And I appreciated how Washington went full bore into those troubling areas as well.
Yeah, I'm with you completely on the performance. I think that there's one key moment, which I'll just say is a confession, when he says to Viola Davis, his wife, Rose, that he has something to tell her. And even before he finally gets those words out, and Washington doesn't cut to a close-up. He doesn't draw more attention to it. He just leaves the camera in the kitchen looking at him. I think Viola Davis is in the shot, too, at that point, but it's definitely on Washington. And you can already see that shame and despair starting to bubble underneath. And at that point, we don't know that he's necessarily going to confess what he confesses, but you know it's something awful just in the way Washington performs it, just in the silent part of that. And you're right, there's not a whole lot of silence to this performance. In fact, the first, I'd say, 30 minutes or so of this movie, I enjoyed because of the writing, and I enjoyed meeting these characters, but his Troy Maxson is not a character I want to spend any amount of time with. And there's a lot of discussion about how he is a charmer. You see that. I think he gets less exhausting, but darker. Mm-hmm. You're absolutely right. That opening 30 minutes or so, though, he is someone who is putting on a play unto himself.
Yeah.
Everybody is his audience, and he just goes, and it is very loud, and it's abrasive in a way that, as a viewer, I found off-putting, just as a person thinking about being in that backyard with him. At the same time, what really fascinated me, and I'd love to hear from some people out there who maybe have seen multiple productions of Fences. I've never read it. I've never seen it performed. Watching Washington play Troy, there's a scene that's a key one. We open the show with it, between him and his son, Corey, where Corey says to him, "How come you never like me?" And then it proceeds to be a one-sided conversation where Troy explains there's no law that says I have to like you. And he goes into this whole rant about how he's his father, he has a responsibility, and all the stuff you'd expect about putting food on the table and a roof over his head and those kinds of things. But I know from watching that scene that there is a way that scene could be performed, even saying all the same words. That scene could be performed on stage or on camera in a way that we feel much more sympathetic towards Troy Maxson, where we know that he's being gruff and that he's being tough on his son, but that maybe it really is out of this deep abiding love, and he's just trying to give him more than he had himself and all those kinds of things, and a vulnerability would come through. Denzel doesn't embrace that at all. There's no good side. There's no sympathetic side. You come away from that really feeling like, okay, there's a bit of a monster in this guy, and I like being around him even less than I thought I did before. I think that's a plus to the performance, actually.
I asked you a question. What law is there say I got to like you?
None.
All right, then. Don't you eat every day? Answer me when I talk to you. Don't you eat every day?
Yeah.
As long as you're in my house, you put a sir on the end of it when you talk to me.
Yes, sir.
You eat every day.
Yes, sir.
Got a roof over your head.
Yes, sir.
Got clothes on your back.
Yes, sir.
Why you think that is?
Because of you.
Hell, I know it's because of me. But why do you think that is?
Yeah, it's funny you describe your experience of that scene that way, because when I first saw it, and they play it up, it's the centerpiece of the trailer, really.
Is it? I've seen
it. And when I saw that trailer, I was waiting for that turn. Mm-hmm. I thought, surely we're going to get that turn. And then it doesn't come in the trailer. And I thought, okay, maybe they're saving that for the movie. And then you watch the movie and no, it doesn't come there either. You know, the fact that Washington played this part on stage opposite Viola Davis is, I think, one of the thrills of this movie, because these performances are so comfortable and lived in that you can feel how the actors are wearing these characters like a second skin.
Yeah.
And there's no hesitation at all that sometimes maybe you can feel in a film performance where rehearsals weren't involved or whatever the reason. This is something that in a good way they could do in their sleep, and yet they're still making it electric. So just seeing the two of them, and Davis gets some standout scenes as well, even though she's very much playing second fiddle to Washington, and so is her character, because Troy is the guy. He holds court over his house, his block, his street, you know, the whole town, it feels like at times. But she definitely gets some moments to shine within that. And you can see why the both of them are being talked about, you know, for acting awards.
For sure. And her best line in this film is one I don't want to mention because I don't want to spoil that moment. And it's not just the line, but it's the moment before it and an exchange that happens between her and her husband that really is incredibly powerful. But what I love about her performance, and it is a powerful performance, if you have seen any clips from it, and I have caught a few, you certainly see Viola Davis giving an emotional performance, and that emotion comes through, her pain comes through, but also what really comes through is her practicality. And I think her practicality as a woman, where she is this figure who is not afforded the luxury of being as grandiose and melodramatic as someone like Troy. He likes to play the victim and talk about how rough he's had it, and he has had it rough, and that all is important to hear, but he certainly likes to play it up and call attention to it. And she is not in that position. At one point, she actually has to say that to him because it doesn't seem clear that he is quite aware of her position in the house and her position within this marriage. But that practicality and that the vulnerability is certainly there with her, but then there's a steely resolve that comes through that I think is born out of that sense of, I have kids to feed, I have a house to run, I have the church to go to, I have my own life that also has to be taken care of, and I have sacrifices I have to make for other people, and I'm going to keep making those sacrifices kind of regardless of what you do. And that really comes through.
When you reference, you know, Troy having a hard life, I think this is another element of Washington's performance that is so impressive, is that he's making this a guy who's charming in one way, scary in another way, always human, okay? Mm-hmm. Very relatable. But here's where the play basis is a benefit. Often plays will, you know, they'll present a domestic drama, but they stand in for a larger slice of society. And somehow Washington manages to make Troy very much this archetypal figure who represents a whole era of men who lived, you know, between Civil War and not yet civil rights, and is torn in that way. He references his life as a child and the difficulties he faced then and the prejudices he faced then. And then he also talks about this job he's trying to get that he gets passed over, driving the garbage truck today because of the discrimination. And yet there are other moments where he resists the future coming in that might bring some change. So in one character, Washington is both, you know, very relatable, very recognizable, and very symbolic in a way that makes this movie, gives it much more heft than maybe a stage-bound domestic drama might initially seem to have.
Yeah, you can understand certainly why this play is as acclaimed and as revered as it is, because there is nothing at all neat about these lives and relationships. And yet, as complex as they are and as messy as they are in terms of those interpersonal relationships, there's nothing messy about the writing or the structure or understanding what every character is after moment to moment. Just think about the dynamics at play here, and this is just the tip of it. The father-son relationships, there's multiple ones here. Father-brother and all the potential guilt that goes along with that. The husband-wife relationship, the mother and stepchildren relationship, and then all these ghosts that they're carrying, like you said, from his past, all these ghosts that are haunting them and the injustices that still haunt them are infused into every moment and every single interaction. You can't just shrug that off and embrace the future as much as we would like to see these characters do. So this is a staggering piece of art. There's no doubt about it. And I think for me, Josh, I do want to at least take a moment to challenge the idea that this isn't as cinematic as maybe it could be or some people think it should be. The simple elegance of the two opening shots, the overhead shot of the garbage truck where we meet Troy with Bono, and that performance, I can't believe I don't have the name in front of me because he is such a good actor and gives such a good performance here, but it's following Troy and his friend Bono on the back of the truck. After that overhead shot, it's a tracking shot It's a little bit longer than a traditional take, but certainly not a really long tracking shot. But it shows us the whole neighborhood. It shows us these guys at work. And it shows these guys at work in a way that I think undercuts all the complaining Troy is actually doing, because all he can talk about is how miserable he is on the job. But later, when he's not on the back of that truck, he's even more miserable.
Because he's alone.
Yeah, because he's alone. And so that's all captured in that opening scene. I think he really makes wonderful use of the frame here, the widescreen format. One of the things that struck me right from the beginning is how much detail is in the edges of these frames. And it also keeps these characters confined within this environment. And they are. They're confined by the fences that they're building, the literal ones and the figurative ones, that backyard, that neighborhood, the city, society as a whole. The frame, I think, really accentuates that. And then something like the long tracking shot when Troy finally gets some good news at work and he comes home with his friend Bono, all triumphant. That's a beautiful cinematic moment. So when you talk about it as a play, well, it certainly could have been more of a play had the camera just been plotted down on a tripod and we just watch the action unfold just like we might if we were in the first or second row of a theater. But that's not what Washington does at all. Besides the camera movements, we also get close-ups, something you don't get on a stage. I don't think there are many awkward moments here at all. I think that Washington and his DP, Charlotte Bruss Christensen, and his editor, Hughes Winborn, I think they really employ close-ups with precision. They're not overused. They accentuate. They do exactly what a good close-up should. Those make for some powerful moments. And then one last scene I'll mention. That confrontation that happens between the son, Corey, and Troy. Not that scene that we've mentioned, but later when Corey comes home from football practice. It's this first moment where he kind of stands up to his father. And he's on the street, and Troy's on the porch. And the way it's framed, we only get one quick establishing shot. Otherwise, they're separated by the frame and by the edits. They're keeping them at a distance from each other. And Troy's very much in control. He's looking down from the porch at Corey, who's on the street. But then when he calls Corey to come face him, and Corey comes to face him in that moment, we get this interesting framing and this interesting staging where Corey actually, the way he's standing on the street, is certainly Troy's equal. He might even be a little bit taller than him. And just that shifting of the perspective there, it makes him an equal in that moment. He's standing up to his father, and he's doing something he's never done up to that point. And he's also, I'll mention, if people know the scene I'm talking about, if they know the play, they know that he's just lobbed at him a real grenade that cuts him down. Anybody who knows Troy, and I think we as viewers who have only gotten to know him so far from what we've seen, we know it cuts him to the core, that it really speaks to one of his central flaws as a man. So again, subtle, but there are a lot of subtle, wonderful little moments with the camera. And again, I think beyond just the use of editing and some of the camera movement, the widescreen itself is another way that this film becomes more than just a stage play.
Stephen Henderson is the actor so you were thinking of.
One of those that guys yeah. we've seen in
yeah,
lots of movies.
Actually got a very, I think it's one scene in Manchester by the Sea from this year. But yeah, he's excellent as this long-suffering friend who has a particularly good scene where he takes the court away from Troy and delivers a bit of wisdom. And you get a sense that he maybe has never done that before.
For sure.
And it's all the more effective for that.
Fences is currently playing in wide release. If you've seen it and agree or disagree with our takes, you can email us feedback@filmspotting.net. A quick plug for our friends at Filmspotting SVU, full name Filmspotting Streaming Video Unit, with our friends Matt Singer and Allison Wilmore. Their most recent episode looks at Cafe Society, Woody Allen's 2016 film, and other love triangle movies that are available for streaming or on demand right now. Cafe Society was the listener's choice vote, and I haven't heard Matt and Allison's reaction yet. I haven't caught up with the episode, but I can't wait to hear it, because being the Woody Allen fan that I am, I'm very disappointed to say that Cafe Society is actually my lowest ranked film of 2016. So the listener's done Matt and Allison wrong in this case.
Wait a minute. Didn't you see Trolls?
No.
No, not Trolls. What's the one I'm thinking of? Angry Birds.
Yeah, I have it higher than Cafe Society.
Cafe Society is lower than Angry Birds.
Yeah.
Well, we just sent a lot of listeners to that episode.
There you go. You can do a search in iTunes for FilmSpotting SVU, or you can go to FilmSpottingSVU.com.
Let's check at what's going on over at the Next Picture Show. This is, I can guarantee, a promising episode because it pairs La La Land, my number 5 film of the year, your number 9 film of the year.
Yep.
With Jacques Demy's Umbrellas of Cherbourg. And then the week after that, they've got another great pairing. It's going to be a Jim Jarmusch double feature, Patterson, of course. And then which of Jarmusch's many films would you want to pair with this? I mean, so many of them would make a nice double bill. They're going to go with his 1984 debut, Strangers in Paradise. I like that.
Yeah, I do too.
All right, when we come back, we're going to revisit a top 5 from earlier this year when we had special guest W. Kamau Bell. He shared his top 5 Denzel Washington performances, and Adam and I chime in with a few quick picks of our own.
Just hard because there's just all these conversations we have to have because racism is just, you know, it's bad right now. We have to have all these people of color. We have to have all these conversations, and unfortunately, we have to have them with white people. It'd be easy if we could just have them with each other. There's racism, right? There sure is. Papa, see you later. And I'm not mad at you, white people. Let me be clear. I'm not mad at you. You're not the ones who are here. You're some of the good ones. You're not like the rest. You speak so well. All I'm trying to say is. You're like, hey, that started out as a compliment, but then it hurt my feelings. I know, I know. I learned it from you, Dad. I learned it from you.
Comedian, activist, and host of many podcasts, W. Kamau Bell there from his 2016 stand-up album, Semi-Prominent Negro. One of Bell's projects is the Denzel Washington is the Greatest Actor of All Time, period, podcast. Full title. That should give you a pretty good indication about its subject. And we were lucky to have Kamau join us in September for our own Denzel Appreciation Show when we shared our top 5 Denzel Washington performances. The episode, Josh, was inspired by the perfectly good Denzel performance in Antoine Fuqua's not so hot Magnificent Seven remake. And with Denzel now directing and starring in the much better Fences, we certainly agree. We thought it was worth revisiting that top 5. Before we get to the conversation, here's a clip from an episode of Kamau's show featuring the one and only Spike Lee.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. We've talked about, obviously, on this show, we talk about Denzel being the greatest actor of all time, period, which we believe. We know you believe that because we heard you say it on Mike and Mike.
Yeah.
Which I suspected before that. I didn't, that you thought that way.
Here's the thing, though. We got to make a distinction.
Okay.
I think Denzel Washington's the greatest actor alive today.
Okay.
Michael Jordan's the greatest player to ever lived. Basketball player.
Did you get some pushback from Michael Jordan or somebody?
No.
Okay.
But here's the thing, though. Mm-hmm. If you put Denzel, and I love D, mm-hmm. could he go toe-to-toe with Paul Robeson? We don't know.
Oh, we don't know. Yeah.
We don't know.
Yeah. Well, okay. Could Jordan go toe-to-toe with Oscar Robertson?
Yes.
Okay.
So when we announced that we were going to do this look back at Denzel Washington's career tied in with the Magnificent Seven review, we heard from a lot of people on social media saying you got to get Kamau Bell on, you got to get someone from that show to talk about Denzel Washington. And the good part was we were way ahead of those Denzelites. We had already reached out to you. So we are very excited to have you on. And that term, Denzelite, all of our best ideas come from our listeners. Did you coin that expression, or is that a pre-existing thing that you latched onto?
No, it wasn't. It didn't exist. I came up with the title. I'll take credit for that. I'm a big fan of, like, crazy long titles. Like my new, we just announced that I have a book coming out that also has a crazy long title. I just think because everybody else, every other podcast and title's gotten shorter. For example, like Serial is the number one podcast, but you have no idea what that's about when you just say, I'm listening to Serial. Mm-hmm. So like, I just feel like I just want a podcast that's very clear what it is so that you know what you're getting into. But then it was actually me and Kevin Avery, we actually shared, it's going to be so much more boring. We shared the same comedy manager for a while, and she was the one who's like, you should call your people Den Zealots. And we were like, thank you, comedy manager. This is the... The rare time our comedy manager actually has a good idea. No offense, every comedy manager, but she, Carrie Smith, she was like that. And so that's where it came from. So, but you know, since then the Denzels have come up with lots of things that have been incorporated into the podcast.
So the basic idea for the show, when you set out at the very beginning, you know, just go through Denzel's films, talk about all these performances. Has that vision been pretty much accomplished as you're approaching, I think, almost 100 shows now, or has it changed a little bit along the way? And basically, what does it feel like to do this now, this many episodes in?
I mean, I think it really started to shift fairly early on. The idea was that we would review every Denzel Washington movie and therefore prove that he was the greatest actor of all time, period. But very early on, we started people reaching out to us because Denzel is an icon and also a very unique icon. Tom Hanks is also an icon, but there's other white guys. Like, there's this sort of like, you know, there's like, you know, if Tom Hanks walks into a room and the other side of the room, like George Clooney walks in the room, we got two white guys, two icons in the room. But Denzel's sort of singular in that there's not another actor of his era that holds a similar space. I mean, Samuel Jackson's great, Morgan Freeman is great, but he's kind of the king, you know?
Yeah.
And so I think that like very early on, people started coming into that, but then it also very quickly turned into a thing that was just generally about diversity in Hollywood. You know, at the time we started doing the podcast, like Oscar So White kicked up again.
Right.
We also started talking about like, they're also Project Greenlight, the season of Project Greenlight had all that weirdness around diversity and Effie Brown going when Matt Damon was like, diversity is on camera, not behind the camera. And I was a big fan of that show, and Kevin's a big fan of Matt Damon, so we had to have a lot of debates about that. And I mean, I think one of the greatest things that the show has done is that, you know, we talked to Ryan Coogler. Now, he's the director of Rocky, but now we talked about his favorite Denzel movies, but it was a really in-depth discussion about Creed. Like, luckily our fans have grown with that and they like that. So we find that we don't actually have to do an episode that's even 50% Denzel for our fans to keep up with it, because Denzel just sort of turns to a discussion about diversity in general.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting how it's evolved to that. So we are going to get to your top five Denzel Washington performances, which I imagine was incredibly difficult considering how big of a fan you are and considering how many great performances he has given. A little bit of setup here, and if I got any of these numbers wrong, I'm sure someone out there will correct me. I looked at his IMDb page. I counted 44 feature film credits. Of those, I've seen 26 of them, so I don't know how good that is or not. I don't know if you've seen all of them or not, Kamau. You can tell us, but I've seen 26 of those 44. He's made 5 with Tony Scott, the director he's worked with the most. Spike Lee 4 times, Antoine Fuqua now 3 times, Ed Zwick 3 times. He, of course, has won 2 Oscars, and I got this from the 538.com article. Speaking of those think pieces, Kamau, the 4 types of Denzel Washington movies, they have him ranked 29th all time in terms of box office. His films have made over $2.2 billion domestically. So just a little bit of background there. Let's actually go ahead and get to your picks. And how did you even begin to come up with your list?
Well, we talked about this in the podcast. I actually learned this from people coming on the podcast, because some people, we make everybody come on and say, what are your top 5 favorite Denzel Washington movies? And very quickly, people were like, do you mean favorite performances or favorite movies? Like, there would be this sort of like split between a Denzel Washington movie I enjoy or a performance that I think is transformative and revelatory. And I never hadn't thought of it that way. So only through other people coming to the podcast, you like Dave Zirin, who's the great political sports reporter, came on with 2 lists. And now it's a pretty common thing for people to do that. Or Ryan Coogler, we call it Cooglering, who would have like tied for number 5 is 4 movies.
I can relate.
Happens on this show.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's called Cooglering.
Okay.
So yeah, so for me, like my favorite movies are pretty different than this list of my favorite performances.
Okay, really?
There's only one. Well, there's 2. I guess that's not very good. But yeah, there's 3 on here that a couple I would have put on my list of favorite movies, but then later through doing the podcast, I'm like, I'm just saying that so I sound smart. It's not actually true.
Yeah, well, just to jump in real quick, I'm curious because we may sprinkle in our choices. I know we did come up with our top 5 as well. Josh, did you end up in a similar place, or are you like me and kind of have your five favorite Denzel movies that also happen to correspond with your favorite performances?
I went with performances, but for me, the tough thing was we have a poll going on right now between best Denzel performance or another poll asking for your favorite. So this is a whole nother can of worms come out that you can get into. And so I got turned around in that a little bit, which has been really tough.
Yeah, and we are going to get to those results later, but I guess I'll give a little bit of a spoiler. A good example there, I think, I don't have him in front of me, but Malcolm X, I think, won for best performance, but Training Day wins for favorite, right? And there is a big distinction between those two performances.
For sure.
That's exactly what I'm talking about. Like, people, there's a sense, and we talk about this in the podcast, there's a sense black people really like to not like Training Day because, like, you know, he's just playing a bad cop. But you cannot deny the immense fun it is to watch him in that performance.
Totally. Like,
you
know, like, totally.
You know, you can sort of get on your high horse and go, I don't think it's good that he won an Oscar for that. And that's also a discussion we can have. But I'm somebody who came around to that and be like, this is just a good – I mean, it's like he is so – he chews up every bit of scenery. And it's so fun to see an actor like that get the – be allowed to sort of just run all over the screen.
I agree.
Like, so it's like – whereas Malcolm X, he literally does the right thing. It's
yeah.
Quickly pun. And it's a great performance. But it's like if honestly, like, I always think of it this way. If there's two TVs or on one TV there's two different movies playing, Malcolm X or Training Day, that's how you figure out your favorite, the one you go, well, I got to go watch this. And I'd watch a little bit of Malcolm X, but eventually I could get to Training Day before he says King Kong.
Exactly. Okay. So
did either of those make your top five then? Both of them maybe?
No, we talked about again. So this is top five performances.
That's right.
Performances.
So number five, I'm going to say Hurricane.
Okay.
Hurricane is – I used to be one of my favorite movies, but if you watch the movie, it's a little bit heavy-handed. And they also have to cover a lot of time. And so it's just that thing where movies have to cover a lot of time. They sort of like – things sort of get attenuated. But that movie did bring me to read about Reuben Hurricane Carter a lot. So, but his performance in that movie, the fact that he plays a guy from like 18 to like, I don't know, 60. Like, and it's not totally unbelievable. And the fact he was 45 years old and ripped in the boxing scenes.
Yeah.
And it has a classic Denzel Washington line. I'm 50 years old. Which me and Kevin Abrams say.
The quivering lip, everything. Yeah.
50 years old. I've been locked up for 30 years.
It's funny about that movie because in that poll question that we're referencing, we gave like the top six answers we thought would be the most common, and we didn't list Hurricane among them. And then we had other where people could write in, and Hurricane scarcely got mentioned. Do you think that there is a valid reason or any reason that you can come up with why that movie for some reason just hasn't held the same esteem over time since it came out?
I mean, I think it has the biopic problem that, like, you know, it's hard to sort of like when you really need to cover a person's whole life, it's hard to do a great job with that or a thorough job with that. Like, you know, every biopic should actually be like a season of television, like where it's like, you know, instead of like cramming it all in.
Agreed.
Also, I think it got a lot of heat at the time.
I remember that. Yeah.
Because it played a little fast and loose with some of the facts, which I felt like. Did we all see A Beautiful Mind? Was that guy like a closeted reprobate? Like, you know,
exactly.
Like, but the movie he was just a crazy math genius. I feel like that was to me like a little bit of a institutionalized racism where like, oh, so this black guy gets heat for playing fast and loose, and then not as fast and loose in the facts as other biopics do regularly.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it sort of that affected it. And also I think it's a little bit like if you want to watch Hurricane, you might as well watch Malcolm X because it's basically a better version of that movie. Hmm. You know, it's a black guy.
Well, he has been in a number of biopics. So, you know, maybe once those start getting ranked in people's minds, Hurricane falls to the bottom.
Yeah, might be.
I just think Hurricane's not really – he's great in it. It's not – I mean, and I say this very – it's not a ton of fun. Like, I think so. It's not like – like Malcolm X, even though it's tragic, seeing him be Malcolm X is fun. It's just – it's amazing, and you're really like, oh, this is one of the greatest things I've ever seen. So Hurricane is great, but I think it maybe doesn't age as well as these other movies. But his performance is absolutely top-notch.
Yeah, a clear one there, as you were saying, that would fit here into your top five performances, but not your top five Denzel movies. What about your number four?
My number four, I'm going to say A Soldier Story.
Love it.
Yeah, Soldier Story is like the first, I think, I mean, maybe he did the carbon copy movie first, but we don't really count that.
Yep.
But yeah, Soldier Story is really like a great movie because it's a murder mystery and Denzel starts out being what you would think is like, oh, this guy's got nothing. And then eventually the reveal, it's like, oh, this guy's got a lot more than I expected.
Yeah.
You know, no spoilers. And I think that like, it's sort of interesting that he ended up being such a leading man because it's really a character performance. Like it's not dominated by him being like the best looking handsome guy. Like he's sort of a nerd for lack of a better word. He's wearing glasses and he's sort of thought as like not being really worthy of anyone's respect in
that's
a lot
true.
Of movies.
Yeah.
And I think to sort of know that, like, that's not where leading actors don't normally start out that way. They normally start out as leading, you know, it's like it's a real character role. Later, he would have been cast in the role that Howard Rollins would have played if they'd done that movie again.
Well, like, that's right. He kind of is in Courage Under Fire, right?
Yeah, yeah. He does the same thing. So I think it's really a testament to the fact that that sometimes in the modern era, we forget that Denzel, if he was less good looking, he would have been a great character actor.
Like, that's absolutely right. Yeah.
He's too good looking, too tall, too good looking to be a character actor. And also, I think that he actually was in a soldier's play, which is why he played the same role in the movie. He was in the soldier's play. And we had David Alan Greer on the podcast, who was also in a soldier's play, that also starred Samuel L. Jackson, was also in that play in New York, and told great stories of, like, actors in the late 70s and early 80s, those guys all being on in a play together. It was amazing.
Yeah, that movie is one. It came out in 84. I was 9 or 10 years old then, and I watched it all the time. For some reason, I think my dad exposed me to it, and I became obsessed with it because it would be on HBO all the time. And so I would just see it constantly, and I do remember him very vividly from that film. And then I remember getting into high school my senior year and having to write a paper for an English class on the Melville short story Billy Budd that was made into a movie in the 60s with Peter Ustinov. And that's basically a soldier story is basically Billy Budd, but set obviously in the army. So yeah. And I love that movie and that book too. So that's one that has always stuck with me. It's a great choice. What about your number three?
Number three, Glory. I sort of struggle, like maybe it should be higher. I mean, that's when for a lot of black people, he became like, oh, so we're going to put him on a postage stamp someday, that he's going to be like, he's going to get his birthday off one day for his black household. He's going to be on the back of Baptist church fans, all for that scene where he plays a very complicated character. Again, a character, it's something a character actor would do because he's not the good guy in the movie. He's a very complicated character, and a character you sort of want to hate, but Denzel Washington's charisma sort of makes it that you're like, I want to hate you, but I can't.
Mm-hmm.
And Glory tier is a thing. Like you can say to somebody, I almost had a glory tier. And people, because of that movie, the fact that he cried out of one eyeball, I mean, it became like this thing where it's like, not only is it a great performance, but he's doing a magic trick. Like, and I mean, it's to this day, you can say to most black people of, you know, probably go glory tier and they know what you're talking about. And many people know what you're talking about. But I think it's just like, it was when he became bigger than just an actor in that movie. And that's a movie, again, you don't get to see a movie where he's acting up against Morgan Freeman and Andre Brower. And, you know, big ups for what's his name? Ferris Bueller in that
Matthew
movie.
Matthew Broderick,
A for
Matthew
effort, Broderick. Let's say.
Well, I'd say a lot of white guys would have been mad at that they were on screen. Like, I would have been like, move out of the way so I can get to them. But he sort of plays a very good, like, I'm not supposed to be here. But I have a lot of respect for Matthew Broderick. Watch that movie. I'm like, he could have been blown off the screen. And he sort of let his naivete allow him not to be blown off the screen. Glory, that's when he becomes a force to be reckoned with.
Yeah, button up that collar. Suck in that gut. Tuck in them big black lips. Lighten your skin. Shrink up that nose.
I don't have to listen to this.
Where you going, boy?
Let me buy.
Let you buy? Let you buy. Let me tell you something, boy. You can march like the white man. You can talk like him. You can learn his songs. You can even wear his suits, but you ain't never gonna be nothing to him but an ugly-ass chimp in a blue suit. Oh, you don't like that, do you?
No.
Well, what we gonna do about it? You want to fight me, boy? Huh? What you gonna do about it? You want to fight me, don't you?
There's no denying, though, that Denzel just manhandles that movie. I mean, he's not really supposed to be the one thing you come out of it thinking about.
But you do.
And,
you're right.
And you do. You absolutely do. I think it's the potent combination of swagger and anger that he has in that role. And it's – you're right. That is a much more – watching scenes from Glory again, it's a much more complicated character than I remember in my memory. It's not the sort of postage stamp character that we might think of. He's really complicated and troublesome and conflicted. And man, making a breakout performance out of something like that takes a special sort of skill.
Yeah, and that was his first Oscar. And I think also the other thing about that, as we talk about the current era of, like, people don't understand, how can Colin Kaepernick say such mean things about America and say he still likes America? Well, it's complicated. And I think, you know, like, go watch Glory. It's really like Denzel ends up basically showing pride in the flag, you know, like, while at the same time hating everything the flag has created. So I think it's for a black person, it's like that character is very relatable. It's like, I totally get that. Like, you know, it's not love it or leave it. It's like, hate it and fix it.
Yeah. And that's funny because we just got done talking about last week on the show, Born on the 4th of July. So this topic seemed very relevant. And then I just actually watched Glory for the first time. Somehow in the 80s, I missed it. I knew that I had to cross this one off before I talked to you or talked to anybody about Denzel Washington. And yeah, his performance is, there's no doubt it's a standout. And that interesting combination you pointed out, Josh, of the kind of swagger and anger and that sense of righteousness is something we get that really comes through in a lot of really good Denzel performances.
Oh, yeah.
But then on the flip side of that are the ones where it always feels like he's repressing that. And that's fascinating too. And that comes through actually a little bit, I think, in his character in The Magnificent Seven, the more quiet, reserved ones, but there's always something underneath the surface you're just waiting to spoil over, to bubble over.
I think that struggle over the idea of righteousness is like, if you look at Denzel Washington as an auteurist actor, like, what's the through line in almost every one of his performances? It's that, and you see it right here in Glory.
Yeah, great pick. Number two.
Number two, we're going with Training Day, which Training Day could easily be number one, but I don't want to get black people mad at me. So I'm going to say number two. Look, it's Training Day. I mean, that movie only works as well as it does because you have a history of Denzel Washington's career behind it to sort of know where he came from. And so I think if he had done Soldier Story and then Training Day, you'd be like, oh, okay, so he's just kind of a jerk, you know, like, but because we'd had a history of Denzel Washington being like this sort of, like, you know, post Malcolm X, like, he's our savior. He's black, you know, he's black Jesus, or Jesus, as some people say.
There you go.
You have this sort of history of him being like this sort of, like, he's our avatar for positive black male role models. And then in Training Day, it's like a meta performance because we're like, how you're watching the character of Alonzo do all these horrible things. We're like, Denzel, how could you do this?
Yeah. Like,
and at the same time, again, his charisma comes through as that character given to another actor would just be like, you know, it would be like Bad Lieutenant where Harvey Keitel, you're just like, I just hate you. Like, you know, like, which is fun to watch, but it's not a box office hit. I think it's Denzel's charisma that turns that into a box office hit. And again, shout out another white guy, Ethan Hawke. I condescended his performance, but the more I've seen it, I'm like, you have to be a strong actor to put up with that guy, and, you know, for the whole movie.
Last year, to be truly effective, a good narcotics agent must know and love narcotics. In fact, a good narcotics agent should have narcotics in his blood.
What are you gonna smoke that?
Nope, you are.
Hell if I am.
Yeah. Yeah, you not?
No.
Why, you're a Mormon or something? You're Jesus freak?
No, man, I'm not losing my job.
This is your job.
I can't do that.
Smoke it.
No.
This ain't a test. Just take a hit. Take a hit.
Man, listen, I became a cop to stop people.
Yeah, yeah, blah, 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 blah. It's not a review board and it ain't cocaine. Take a hit.
No, man.
I like the idea of his performance in Training Day being a meta performance that in the way you talked about, but also because when I watch it, I feel like he's screaming at Oscar voters the whole time. It's like, I don't know what you've been waiting for, but fine. Here it is. Berates them into giving him his best actor Oscar, which they finally did.
Yeah, as the great comedian Greg Proops said, and it was one of those jokes I wish I'd written, and he said this before he won the Oscar, he's like, and finally they're going to give this guy who's played Biko and Malcolm X and Reuben Hurricane Carter, they're going to give him an Oscar for playing Pimptatious McGee.
That's pretty much it.
Times. I was just like, that's good. I wish I'd written that.
That's so great. All right, well, what's better than Training Day? What's your number one?
Performance. Malcolm X is the Michael Jordan of Denzel Washington movies. Like, it's just like, you can sort of argue against it for fun as not being the greatest, but that's the greatest performance because it's also the most important performance, because when he took the movie Malcolm X, there was a lot of talk of, like, can he pull this off? There's a lot of, like, amongst the black community, he's too dark skinned to do this. He doesn't look enough like Malcolm. We should get a lighter skinned guy. There's all this sort of talk about this book is impossible. Spike Lee's doing it. Is Spike Lee going to do a good job? Is he able to do an epic movie like this? You know, Spike Lee ran out of money, and then, like, black celebrities gave him money to finish the movie. It all is tied into also the fact that it was one of the first movies that sort of that went viral before it came out through the X caps and the X shirts that people were like people like Michael Jordan were wearing. Like, so the movie marketing became a part of the story. Like, I had an X shirt and an X cap, and I didn't even wear baseball caps. But it was just like, it was a phenomenon, a cultural phenomenon that now movies try to replicate. Every movie tries to replicate sort of like a viral marketing campaign. And Spike Lee sort of pioneered that with Malcolm X. And that movie, without that movie, I wouldn't have read the autobiography of Malcolm X when I did. I was like, oh, I should probably read the book before I see the movie. And that book changed my life. And Denzel, there's moments in that movie, if you've seen a lot of pictures of Malcolm X and you see Denzel in that movie, he looks like Malcolm X, which doesn't make sense because he doesn't look like Malcolm X.
No, you're absolutely right.
And so that's why, and he's always talked about like he's a very spiritual, religious man. He keeps it on down low a lot of times, but it's like he really feels like he was channeling Malcolm X. And I'm like, I don't know enough about that to know if that's true, but there's times that movie go, it doesn't make sense. He looks like Malcolm X, even though he doesn't. And I mean, there's this, I mean, you know, one of the most quoted speeches in my life that we use as part of the rating system on the show is, oh, I say and I say again, you've been had, you've been took, you've been hoodwinked, bamboozled, led astray, run amok. This is what he does. I just did a very poor job of it. That speech is like, again, it's like, it's just one of those things where you can say that to probably to a certain generation of black people. They go, yeah, Malcolm X. And the funny thing about that, there's no evidence that Malcolm X ever said that, the real Malcolm X. But it's one of the most quotable. And again, we didn't land on Plymouth Rock. There's no evidence that the real Malcolm X said that I've ever seen. But Denzel said it. So now it's one of the most popular Malcolm X quotes. Like, he sort of took over the legacy of Malcolm X in that movie in a way that you realize is so gigantic when you compare that to, and not that I'm putting down his performance, but like Will Smith and Ali, it's fine.
Yeah.
It's not bad.
I think there's something similar between those two performances, though. And yeah, I mean, Denzel's is far superior, but both are taking actors who are known for their charisma, right? They just have this molten hot charisma and playing figures from history who had the same thing. And so that could go really poorly, but somehow I think Will Smith pulls it off, but even more so Washington, they managed to morph those different types of charisma into something that's wholly new, like what you're talking about, Kamau, where those speeches are considered, it's not Denzel, it's not Malcolm X, it's this wholly new thing that is so powerful, it has this pop cultural cachet now that we all recognize.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to tell you like it really is. Every election year, these politicians are sent up here to pacify.
Right.
They're sent here and set up here by the white man.
Right.
This is what they do. They send drugs in Harlem down here to pacify us. They send alcohol down here to pacify us. They send prostitution down here to pacify us. Why, you can't even get drugs in Harlem without the white man's permission. You can't get prostitution in Harlem without the white man's permission. You can't get gambling in Harlem without the white man's permission. Every time you break the seal on that liquor bottle, that's a government seal you're breaking. Oh, I say it, I say it again. You've been had. You've been took. You've been hoodwinked. Bamboozled. Led astray.
Oh, this is just footage of Malcolm X they got. I thought he was more light-skinned. Anyway, let's keep watching.
You know. Well, so with Malcolm X at number one, really that perfect crossover then, the synthesis of great movie and great performance. And I'm with you completely. Josh, were you number one Malcolm X as well in your list?
I had He Got Game as my number one Denzel performance, and that's only because I revisited a fair amount of it in the last week. I had forgotten how good that movie
is. Yeah, I've got it at number four.
Oh, good, good.
Yeah.
Excellent. I mean, this is, again, like in Glory, a really complicated, in some ways nasty guy, far nastier than the character in Glory, but the shades he brings to that in He Got Game, and plus – that Dr. J. Afro, I mean, that might have put it over the top for me at number one.
Yeah. I mean, that movie is amazing. That's a movie that I haven't seen as much as the other Denzel movies. And I think that it's like a classic Spike Lee movie, and that it's kind of a Trojan horse. You think it's about one thing, but it's really about another thing.
Absolutely.
When I rewatched his performance, the movie for the podcast, I was like, oh yeah, this is way better than I remembered. And we had Spike Lee on our podcast, and it was a great episode. We did like all talked to him about all the movie times he'd worked with Denzel. It's also a thing where I told Spike, like, I wouldn't have picked – when you had Ray Allen in that movie back in the day, I was like, why this guy? And then Ray Allen ends up being one of the greatest basketball players in the history of all time, period. Like,
right.
Oh, you're smarter than me, Spike Lee. That's why.
Yeah, exactly.
So, yeah, I know he's great. Kevin Avery, one of Kevin Avery's Denzel, who's the co-host of my podcast, one of his favorite Denzel scenes in a movie is in He Got Game when he hits a guy in the throat.
Oh, man. And he is so vicious there. And I love the touch at the end where, and this speaks to the layers of his character, he runs. You know, it's not like this big victorious, he is the tough guy. He just knocked this guy out. But then he also realizes what that means for him and his life. And he takes off running down the street. I love that touch.
Yeah, no, it's like it's at that moment where he hits the guy goes down. He also says, like, keep breathing, breathe. And then
that's such a Denzel moment. Yeah.
I don't really want to hurt you, but, but also, oh, shit, I'm going to get out of here.
Exactly.
But,
yeah,
it's, I mean, there's so many, like, I'm sort of upset that I didn't get Man on Fire on here because I think that's that's the thing that I keep going.
That's a good transition, maybe real quick, as we consider any other movies you did strongly consider or ended up as honorable mentions, is we've mentioned a couple of the ones for our list, and we're certainly not going to go into any detail at this point because you've done an amazing job illustrating why Denzel's so great in your picks. But I had at number five, Deja Vu, because I felt like I needed a Tony Scott film on here, and their collaboration being obviously the one that he's collaborated with that director the most. And I was thinking about it just in terms of Man on Fire or some of these other titles, The Taking of Pelham 123. If you had another movie star in any of those roles, say someone like Bruce Willis, who I think is a fine movie star, would he have ever been able to bring an ounce of the emotional complexity and depth, that righteousness, but then couple that with that kind of vulnerability or that humanity that he brings that makes those movies rewatchable? Denzel is the reason why. I mean, Tony Scott, I know a lot of us have come to appreciate his filmmaking more over the years, but it's Denzel that makes those movies worth revisiting, I think. What about you, Kamau? Yeah, I mean, you sound like you're not a big fan of that film.
Of Deja Vu?
Yeah.
I enjoy that movie. It's one of those things where it's like there's some movies, and this is true of all actors, where I think he's great in that movie, and I think Denzel does elevate a movie beyond where it can normally – like you can take a bad movie and it's like, you know, it becomes better with Denzel. That one to me just feels very much like – I like watching that movie, but if it had been Tom Cruise, I wouldn't have stepped near it. You know, like I wouldn't have like it. So it's like the movie in and of itself to me is sort of, it's a very sort of mainstream Hollywood vehicle.
Sure.
Which I'm not anti that, but it feels like, and Denzel's got a lot of those on his thing where you're like, this could have been, I think he brings a lot to it, but it could have been anybody.
Yeah.
Whereas like Malcolm X is either Denzel or nobody else. Like, you know, Training Day is either Denzel or it becomes a much different movie. Deja Vu might have been a bigger hit with Tom Cruise because he's a white guy and we tend to enjoy white guys running around after explosions more than we like black guys doing it. You know what I'm saying?
So, no, very valid. Though, to my point, I don't think I would want to go back and rewatch the Tom Cruise version, but Denzel makes me...
And I don't mean to condescend to Tom Cruise either. I mean, Jack Reacher, I'm looking forward to the sequel when I see it.
Aren't we all? Right? So real quick, I'll just list them. Number four, I had He Got Game. Number three, I had Devil in a Blue Dress. And this is one where if I was just ranking the movies, it might be lower. But I love his Easy Rollins. I love every bit of that. And, of course, love Don Cheadle as Mouse as well. Number two, Inside Man. And number one, Malcolm X. So three of the Spike Lee movies in there in my top five. What about you, Jack?
I've got Devil in a Blue Dress right there at number three, too. I think that speaks to his timelessness. I mean, he slips into that, what is it, about 1948
million. Yeah. Post-World War
II. So easily. And that puts him up there with the all-time actors when you can do that, shift eras. So I had Flight at five, a movie I'm very mixed on, but man, he just about pulls that thing out in the last 10 minutes. Isn't quite able to. Malcolm X, I've got at four because I do really like him so much in Devil in a Blue Dress. At three, that might be his sexiest performance, Devil in a Blue Dress.
For sure.
Glory, I've got up there at number two. And then, as I mentioned, He Got Game is number one.
Okay, so Kamau, any other thoughts on any of those or any of the other films that you regret that you couldn't squeeze in there?
Yeah, I mean, there's a film that I've really come to respect a lot because of the podcast, and that when I rewatched it, I was like, oh, this is even more important now. I think it's a sort of, and I think a lot of people have made me respect it more, but I watched it and I was like, this film still holds up. That it just didn't make it. I just didn't, and if I put it in, I would have just been trying to sound smart, but Philadelphia is maybe the most interesting Denzel Washington movie that there is. Like, it's just the fact that he, in the course of the movie, goes from homophobe to not homophobe, and he's a black man, which in the black community, there's a lot made out of us being more homophobic than other people, which I don't believe to be true. But Tom Hanks gets the credit for Philadelphia, but Denzel's character is the anchor of the movie.
Yeah, I agree. I actually just saw parts of that movie recently on TV, hadn't seen it in years, and some of those courtroom scenes are fantastic, and Denzel is why, and Jonathan Demme's camera, and those point of view shots where he's talking right to us as the jury, as the audience, I think are really effective. Yeah. You're right, Denzel is great there. He also worked, of course, with Demme on The Manchurian Candidate, which maybe not as good as the original Manchurian Candidate, but still a quality film.
Yeah, I like that one.
Meryl Streep is amazing in Manchurian Candidate, yep. It's just, which is funny, that's one of, we had Spike Lee list his top five Denzel Washington movies, but we wouldn't let him put his own movies in there.
Oh, man.
And so he listed Manchurian Candidate, which I was like, oh, interesting. So, yeah.
Well, we will definitely link to that episode in our show notes at filmspotting.net, the one with Spike Lee, and link to your podcast. And I can't say how much fun this was. Thanks so much for taking the time again, Kamau.
Thanks, Kamau.
Thanks for having me. Happy to do it.
This isn't an election. This is a coup. This is, in our own country, a regime change in our own country.
Ben, don't. Ben.
This is rich people, Manchurian Global, funding bad science to put a sleeper in the White House. And that's what's going on, Rosie. That's what's going on.
Greatest actor of all time, period. Denzel Washington in a clip there from Jonathan Demme's Manchurian Candidate remake. Our thanks again to W. Kamau Bell for taking the time back in September to share his top five Denzel performances. Kamau's 2016 comedy album, Semi-Prominent Negro, is out now on the Kill Rock Stars label. More about Kamau and all his projects is at wkamaubell.com. And you can find Denzel Washington as the greatest actor of all time, period, wherever you get your podcasts. I'm glad I don't have to say the name of our show, that it's not that long every
not
time.
That long.
You get
no.
tired. Yeah.
No, it is fun to say, though. That's this week's show. You can send comments to feedback@filmspotting.net. We are also on Facebook and Twitter. I'm at Filmspotting. Josh is at Larson on Film. Also at filmspotting.net is where you can find almost 12 years of reviews, interviews, and top fives in the show archives. And if you haven't already, please check out those Film Spotting Family Podcast, The Next Picture Show, and Film Spotting SVU. You can find both in iTunes. Out wide this weekend, Hidden Figures, which, Josh, you have seen.
And I have to admit, I saw it because my daughters requested to watch it. It wasn't one that initially appealed to me, but I'm glad I did. It's got some great performances. The cast is headlined by Taraji P. Henson, Octavia Spencer, and Janelle Monáe. And actually, Monáe, who we both appreciated in Moonlight, shows some flickers here of being a real star. I think these two films are her debuts. So she's really good in it.
A Monster Calls also out, the latest from Juan Antonio Bayona, and we have certainly split on him. We love The Orphanage. We split in a major way on The Impossible, and this is one that you kind of recommended.
Yeah, mild recommendation.
But not for me. You said there's no way
I don't think
this
you
movie.
Should go near it.
Fair enough. Well, let's see if I'll go near Underworld Blood Wars. It is the fifth installment in the Underworld series. And Martin Scorsese's Silence also getting an expanded release. We both recommend that film, though it did not make our top tens. It did make Scott Tobias'
yeah,
top made Scott's. 10.
Are you ready to talk about it at some point?
I'm not.
I know you said you're still recovering, processing. What's the...
No, it's more just that I saw it like 5 weeks ago.
It's been a while.
It's been
true.
A while, and I really need to see it again. When that happens, maybe we will be able to give it some time here on the show. Next week, it's a week off for our podcast listeners and for us as we prep for our live show on January 13th. Again, tickets are available and more information is available at filmspotting.net about that. Radio listeners will get more Best of 16 stuff. We're going to replay our special 600th episode from back in August featuring author Chuck Klosterman, in which we looked a couple centuries into the future for the top five movies future historians will remember. That was an incredibly fun episode, though daunting episode to record. It must have come out okay. A little bit of back padding here. Recently, IndieWire named its top 50 podcasts, not film podcasts, just podcasts of the year. And that 600th episode clocked in at number 16.
So it's nice to see.
Thank you, Steve Green, and thank you, IndieWire, for that.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths and the listeners of the Film Spotting Advisory Board. And special thanks to everyone at WBEZ Chicago. More information is available at WBEZ.org. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is listener supported. Join the Film Spotting family at filmspottingfamily.com and get access to ad-free episodes, monthly bonus shows, our weekly newsletter, and for the first time, all in one place, the entire Film Spotting archive going back to 2005. That's at filmspottingfamily.com.